Well, thank you for coming, and it's very, very good to see those of you that are here. The sort of an overview or a preview of what we want to do in the next 50 minutes is simply this. I'm going to present some information concerning conflict resolution or interpersonal peacemaking. Try to stay as general as possible so that we can make applications across the board in our human relationships. Like the other sessions that I have attempted to give, this will always be in the context of the gospel, in the context of sacred scripture, and most assuredly in the Greek scriptures, the New Testament. I also will invite at some point in time, or any time that you want to, please feel free to kind of jump in, ask questions, ask for clarity. If you have difficulty understanding or buying into or even disagree, that would be wonderful, because then we get a chance to do some of this stuff for real right up front. That's what that's all about. Normally I work, give something, then you get into small groups. Today we're going to keep it pretty much in one large group, but I do invite dialogue and questions, that kind of thing. When we talk about conflict resolution, or as the subtitle would suggest, interpersonal peacemaking, it occurs to me that, to use the language off of the block, for a person to really be good at conflict resolution, for a person to really be effective at interpersonal peacemaking, they've got to, what the kids call, have their own stuff together. And so one really, it becomes difficult. I won't say impossible, but it becomes very difficult to do peacemaking, to initiate conflict resolution, if I myself am not at one with me, or if I myself do not have some presuppositions about what I'm all about. And so it does not come by accident that today, when we celebrate one of the great eras, I believe, in humankind, the dropping of the atom bomb, and hindsight is so very crystal clear, that we should talk about conflict resolution. One of the things that perhaps we might want to explore before we actually get into some very specific and practical down-to-earth things on conflict resolution is, as Christians, where do we draw our strength for being peacemakers? The answer may be obvious, but on the other hand, it might not be so obvious. One of the things that was promised to us is that indeed we would have peace, that peace would be given to us. One of the things that Jesus promised to his apostles during his farewell discourse, the very same night he went out and was to be tried and ultimately hung on a cross, was that peace, my peace I give to you, and my peace I will leave with you. So for us as Christians, some 2,000 years later, after all this takes place, we are inheritors. We are the ones who reap the benefit of this peace, if in fact we indeed buy into what this young, radical, itinerant preacher had to say back in Galilee many, many, many centuries ago. A young man named Jesus, who died at a very, very young age, at his prime. Perhaps he had not even reached his prime, as we understand it. Given the lifespan back then, Jesus had just about, was about ready to reach his prime, when, knowing well what he was doing, he went on to his death. But on the night before he died, he indeed gave these discourses. John records that for us, in his writings, in his gospel account, and it probably took place after the Last Supper. You know, John the evangelist did not write the particulars of the Last Supper as the other three did. John goes off on a different tack and writes to us all the different things that Jesus did in the 13th chapter. He's washing his apostles' feet. In the 14th chapter, he's really praying for them and preparing them for the world. And we go on to see that indeed he's leaving in peace. And he tells him, I'm going to send you somebody, send someone to help you out, comforter. He's talking about the Holy Spirit. So if we as Christians, followers of Christ, believers in the gospel, people who are endeavoring to somehow use that as a standard in our lives, in the day-to-day, mundane, practical aspects of living in this very, very highly technological society, and a world that simply does not see the gospel as any real meaningful kind of foundation, if we as Christians really buy into that, I think we may find that interpersonal peacemaking is a reality. It is something that can indeed take place. Not directly related to what we're talking about, but certainly in some fashion or another, there's a statement that you might want to run through your head, and for me, it challenges me every time I think about it. There is no limit to the good one can do if they don't care who gets the credit. There is no limit to the good one can do if they don't care who gets the credit. Somehow that came to me, and I thought maybe I'd throw that out as part of the presentation. Another point, when we talk about peace, we are not talking about milquetoast, wishy-washy wins. We're not talking about that at all. And that's really to be understood. I think sometimes, not always, but sometimes in our society, to be a peacemaker, when one asks to be an instrument of peace, it means that you're going to be sort of a milquetoast wimp and not willing to stand up for what you believe in. So peacemaking does not mean to be passive all the time, and it certainly does not mean that you allow evil to run roughshod over you. But on the other hand, it does call for a tremendous amount of self-confidence in the context of the teachings of Jesus, at least for us as Christians. If this was a group of Islamic folk or a group of people who followed the Tao, or people who were believers in the Sufi mysticism, strangely enough, when it comes to this particular subject, peace, the rhetoric would be almost the same. It's really amazing, the universality of peace among peoples. Well, I'll get back to that in a little bit, but let me kind of walk through some very, very sharp, I would hope, clear didactic stuff about conflict resolution. The one thing I don't want to do for the remaining 45 minutes is to sit here and give you a lot of aesthetic and a whole lot of esoteric stuff without some practicality. So I would like very much to leave you with some very, very practical tools that you can probably put to use tonight over the dinner table when somebody doesn't pass the salt and they're messing around with the bread and you want some bread and they won't give it to you. So I'd like to move away from that higher level of theory and really talk about peacemaking as it deals with the interpersonal stuff in the home, in the family. You know, whose turn is it to do the dishes? Weren't you supposed to put the garbage out this morning? How come you forgot? Or did you just ignore it? Those kind of things. And yet, those very kinds of things are what make us strong. If there's to be peace in the world and peace among peoples, then it has to start with us and it has to really start in the home. So, the nature of human conflict. Human conflict can be broken down into four major categories. And the amazing thing, at least to me, about that is that whether we're talking about sister and brother having a dispute over whose turn is it to do the dishes or who's going to wash and who's going to dry, or if it's a dispute between two political parties, or it's a dispute between two regions, a dispute between two countries, the four categories apply. It makes no difference. It's really quite amazing, at least to me it is. So, the nature. Of human conflict is what we want to look at. The nature of human conflict is that there are four types. The first type, and it really doesn't make any difference how you list them. I happen to list them as I've experienced them most in my life, is intrapersonal. Intrapersonal conflict is the incongruence that I experience in myself when I can't make up my mind. Should I or shouldn't I? And if I side with this group, what about my friend who belongs to this group? If I take Grandpa's stand, what is that going to do for Uncle Jim? And after all, that is Mom's brother. Those are the kind of things. That's the real issues. We're not talking about out here where we're talking about nuclear disarmament, and those are important, and breaking down the Berlin Wall and people getting together. But I'm talking about the stuff that you live with every day in your life. If I take this stand, what is the union shop steward going to say to me? How will I look if I take this stand? And what are the guys on the block going to say when I stand up and say, I don't go for that, or I really believe in this, and everybody expects me to walk the party line? So the first type of conflict that exists is intrapersonal, and usually comes from my inability to make a choice, or comes from the challenge that I'm faced with, indeed, to make a choice. The second one, or the second type, is interpersonal. That is the conflict that exists between me and one, at least one other person. Intra-group. I see this a lot in my ministry. My wife and I, when we work with dysfunctional families or members of families or a single head of household, almost invariably, there is an internal strife going on within that basic unit of society, the family. And members are not getting along together. So when you have intra-group conflict, that which goes on inside of a unit, a group, organization, family, almost invariably, these two things are happening. People are at real odds. They feel really, really under pressure inside themselves, and they usually have a disagreement going on between themselves and somebody else, or they're at odds as to what side to take. And then, of course, the other one would be intergroup. Us guys against the guys across town, us folks against those guys over there, and so on and so forth. It doesn't take much of an illustration to stretch your imagination in those areas. So these are the types of conflict, the category of conflict. And then the content. Of the conflict is the next thing. It usually has to do with attitude, values, and beliefs. And they're all locked in together. It's very difficult to talk about values without talking about attitude, and it's very difficult to talk about attitude without talking about beliefs. But nevertheless, that's one level. The other one has to do with material things. In order for you to marry my daughter, or in order for your daughter to marry my son, sorry for the Western thinking, I slipped there. In order for you, for your daughter to marry my son, I require of your daughter 3 mules, at least a water buffalo, a catch of spears, a jeep, enough parts to keep my car running or my truck running for a year, and at least $150 for each one of the members of the family that she represents. That's the unit of exchange. And if you can't come to that, then we're in great conflict. We're not going to do it. We won't get together. Our families won't unite. Never mind how the kids feel. We just won't get together. Other material resources have to do with items
value. And it's amazing.
As painful as death is, after the funeral, and after all of that has taken place in the family, it's incredible to watch people fight over what's left. Uncle Johnny promised me this chest a long time ago, and I'm getting it, and if you don't give it to me, we're going to court. That's it. That chest is mine, and I want it. It's wonderful being Christians, isn't it? We just love one another. And then finally, and it may not be necessarily just these by themselves, they almost always work in combination. Well, there it is. And once again, this applies to individuals, it applies to groups, it applies to regions, it applies to countries, it applies to different kinds of people within countries. So this is the nature of human conflict. So moving right along then, since this is a presentation on resolution, the next step is, well, what do we do about that? How do we handle that? Any questions about that before I go on? Any thoughts? Okay. You might be thinking at this point in time, what are your conflicts? What is it that you'd like to resolve? How will you go about doing it? And what is the nature of your conflict? That's later on down the line in this presentation, but it is something to begin to roll around in your head. One thing I would like to add, almost invariably, when we have a conflict, we don't operate in categories. Almost invariably, there are multiple conflicts going on inside of us, and almost invariably, there's at least two of these going on inside of us simultaneously. I just don't have an interpersonal conflict alone, isolated. If I do, and if it's strong enough, and if I don't deal with it, it will spill over into my relationships with others, and if nothing else, a low-level conflict will exist. The fact that, have you noticed, Bill is not the same, you know, are you paying attention to me? What's preoccupying you? He's not the same. So my behavior and my attention will begin to impact on my other human relations. Okay, I'm going to take all this off and talk about the resolution itself. Conflict resolution is best seen perhaps if illustrated or laid out on a board in a continuum. This is one pole, and this would be the other. And somewhere in between, we have the stages or the intensity of the conflict itself and trying to resolve it. At this end of the pole, to your left as you look at it, this is avoidance. We just simply avoid it. Avoidance behavior. We don't talk about it. Now we brief all the children. Grandpa Bill is coming over this evening, and he's going to be here, so I want you, first of all, since you know he's coming, I've told you last week, get a haircut. You know how he rages about your hair. Get a haircut. And for heaven's sakes, don't play the music too loud, because you know how he is. I want you to put away all those crazy magazines, because Grandpa gets a little self-righteous, and you know, after all, he's going to be here, and let's just have peace. Let's not get into this discussion. And Jim, I don't want you to talk about the Republicans or the Democrats. Just don't, please, let's just have some peace tonight because Grandpa's coming and you know how he is. And what Mom is doing is really just trying to avoid all of this stuff. That's one way to deal with it. It lowers the level of intensity. But in fact, it doesn't really get rid of the conflict. Conflicts are not resolved when you avoid them. They will always exist. Some people never resolve their conflict. What they do is they exercise avoidance behavior. Since we can't get along, let's break up, you go your way, I'll go mine. The conflict has not been resolved. We simply have decided not to interact. So there's a real difference. When we talk about resolution and management, often in the training and development industry where consultants come in and they try to work with companies and organizations, and the like, we will see the terminology conflict management or anger management. The major difference is that resolution does not always take place, and in many cases it never is resolved. It's just that we have agreed not to fight about it and not to talk about it. So, avoidance is one end. The other, middle of the road is diffusion. We diffuse the content. Now what do I mean by that? Well, what I do is I put so much smoke on the water and load it up with so much stuff that you don't even know what the conflict is about. You thought you knew, but it's kind of hazy. Sort of like the news that we get at 6 o'clock. It's been said that at 6 o'clock when the news comes on across the country, prime time, and if it's a 30-minute program, unless you're watching PBS, and even then that sort of focuses on a very narrow thing, and even that may indeed be content full of editorializing and not just straight skinny. It just depends on who you're watching. But if you're watching a regular network news program, 30 minutes of news is what's allocated. You will probably get 17 minutes of commercials, sports and weather, another 12 minutes of editorializing, and if you're lucky, maybe 3 minutes of real news, uncut, uncensored. It's kind of interesting to watch the middle of the week when there's nothing going on, at least in my region of the country. We get all the news about the different fires that broke out in people's houses, fires and truck accidents, and we're going to take you now to the freeway where live Cairo 5 is now looking at the freeway. We've got a jam up going through the 405. I mean, what do I care? I can't do anything about it. But it's news. And so we find ourselves there watching. It's very, very diffused. Nothing is really happening. On the job, something comes up, we hear it, we hear stories, we hear rumors. If you are interested, the second session of this week will deal with inferential listening and getting the facts. We hear those kind of things, and we really don't know what the problem is. We have no way of knowing. That's done intentionally almost always, either out of avoidance or on purpose to keep you from coming to resolution.
What would it be like for kids with the arguing and you kind of can't get to the bottom of it because there's no, can you do this, can you do that?
Right. Another example of diffusion might be that you hear that there may be a riff on the job, but to kind of cover that up, we now are talking about the New Deal on quality control issues. We're going to be doing a survey on productivity, and one department is going to do a pilot program, and there's negotiations going on with the union and management. And you say, but what about the possibility of me getting riffed? I mean, well, we'll wait and see about it. We're not sure. Don't go off half-cocked. We're working on it. So at this point, you don't really know what's going on. It's really interesting. For the longest kind of time, we never really knew what was going on in South America. It's diffusion. We never really knew what was happening in South Africa. Unless you were there or had privy to special information, which your lips were sealed because of some sort of security act, many of us never really knew what was going on in Vietnam. We never really knew. And we still don't know what's going on right now. Totally around the world. We're not too sure. We don't know if we have all the facts about the recent massacre of those refugees in the Lutheran Church. Nobody really has the whole story. It's diffusion. And nobody will ever, I think, know really what happened with the with that whole Iran-Contra thing. I mean that the stuff's been shredded and disappeared, and one of the principal people involved in that is the President of the United States today. Well, and I'm not saying anything for or against, I'm just giving you some facts. I don't think we'll ever have all the information. So from kids on the ball field who said, he said that she said and I did not and they did, and you're trying as a counselor to get to the bottom of it or as a parent to get to the bottom of it, from that kind of thing to the very global kinds of issues, it's diffusion. Confrontation is the beginning of resolution. Confrontation is not bad. May not always be good, but it isn't necessarily bad. Depends on how we deal with confrontation. Confrontation breaks itself down and two possibilities. Win-lose. And resolution.
Win-lose, we're back to square one. Because if we have a confrontation and I win over you, then we have not resolved the thing at all. What I've done is I've exercised more power than you're able to exercise. I hold you at bay, but I better never turn my back on you. So I have to use a certain amount of energy to maintain defense, to make sure that you won't get me, and I have to keep flexing my power and play the power role so as to keep you in place. We have wonderful euphemisms for this. Containment, strategic kinds of planning things that make sure that we have deterrence. And they work, because I'm not saying that we're the bad guys, I'm just saying the conflict is always there and there was no resolution. Now it seems that maybe there may be some resolution among superpowers. And what has resolved it is that, remember the content, territory and money? The economic conditions are so bad in certain parts of the world that we just can't maintain that kind of force anymore. So maybe we ought to do something different. But that is the key to resolution, confrontation. When lose, nobody wins. And resolution means that we come together in synergy. Synergy is the collective use of power to resolve a situation. Synergy is the combined use of strength to obtain a common goal. The Oriental people have a wonderful way of showing that in the yin-yang. When I'm in this space, you compromise, and I compromise, and you have this space. So that we really learn, in fact, how to dance together. I think there's enough of us here that can remember slow dancing where we're not out there on the floor doing it by ourselves while you're doing your thing, I'm doing mine. I mean, you really hold somebody. That's nice, isn't it? Oh, I love that. I don't know what happened to those things. But anyway, when you do that, you've got to really kind of work together, because otherwise you're kicking somebody's foot, stepping on somebody's toes, tearing cuffs and putting runs in stockings, and that isn't very nice, and it's darn right embarrassing. So when you learn how to dance, it's amazing how it works. That's what synergy is really all about, learning how to dance. The metaphor is really applicable to one-on-one dancing, to countries getting along, or peoples getting along. Any questions before I move on? Once again, for those of you that have come in late, I really welcome dialogue and questions. There won't be much group stuff today. This is straight skinny stuff, and I really do welcome questions and dialogue. Okay.
I have a question.
Go.
Is there any redeeming value to the fusion, or does it just cause delays and confusion?
Sometimes one has to make a decision when they're in a position to know what's going on. To use. There are some redeeming, there's even redeemed values to avoidance. It's a good question, because I may have left you with the impression that there wasn't. Sometimes you may have to keep things diffused in order to allow for the common good to do something to avoid more injury or more loss of resources or even human life. A good example, let me see if I can give you an example. If, for instance, somebody had infected a water system and it was almost imminent that if we didn't do something about it within the next 48 hours, people would really be in great trouble. The people would be subject to infection and that type of thing. It may indeed, if there has not been a leak, then you can just simply avoid dealing with that and get the thing done. Do a regular problem-solving thing. And although some people say we ought to let the public know, and if you're in a position to hold that information back and avoid any panic and resolve the situation before indeed something happens, there may be something to make it easier But always at the end, there has to be some sort of resolution. Well, at the beginning, I had said that it really depends. It depends. We have to make some presuppositions. Not everybody is willing to enter into resolution for a variety of reasons. But all of this, mind you, is given in the context of how we as Christians think. In order to be a good person to resolve the conflict, one needs, first of all, some very practical skills, some basic skills. But the other piece, to be willing to get into the resolution dynamic, one has to have somewhat of their own stuff together. If I'm so defensive about where I am that I won't listen to you, then there's something that I don't have working in me. So this is not a panacea to resolve all human conflict, and in some cases, people don't want to. I might say this will work. What I'm about to demonstrate to you will work only if you can draw on the other person who is willing to exchange. Some people simply are not willing to do anything. So this is not the answer to all human strife. But when you can see it working, when you are able to initiate confrontation, and you're able to initiate dialogue, then almost certainly, if there is no resolution, there certainly has got to be some different perspective about what this is all about. So, yes, sometimes people just don't want to listen. And when they don't, then you have to go on and try to do the best thing you can. If at all possible, shake the dust off your sandals and keep on going. Somebody said that, didn't they? Oh, well, anyway, moving right on. So we have the first, win-lose doesn't work. The other one is confrontation, dealing with... So confrontation is not bad. Confrontation means meeting the situation head on with some goodwill to resolve the conflict, okay? Here we go. The first thing that one needs is one must determine the nature of the conflict. It is simply amazing. If you have a conflict going on in the office or in the home, it is really, really a breakthrough when you can get two people to sit down and tell you and to at least agree that this is what the conflict is. It's simply amazing how many people have conflict. But my conflict is this with you, and you don't see it that way at all. Your conflict is over here. So when you can arrive at agreement as to the nature of the conflict, when you yourself can come up and you think that this is what this is all about, then that's a breakthrough. It really is a breakthrough. So if I myself am in conflict with someone and I want to resolve the conflict, before I come up to you and say something to you, I need to sit down and really think it out. It doesn't hurt to get a piece of paper and write it out. Really, what is the conflict here? What is going on here? Is it because I really like to sit by the window and be able to see? And is that essential for me to do what I have to do in my office? Or is it because I just really do feel boxed in and I think I would feel emotionally and psychologically better by an open space? If I just like the window because that's always where I like it, then I need to maybe examine that. Maybe I ought to try and still get the window position, but at least I'm being able to go into the conflict understanding what it is. Is it attitude, value, belief, or is it just a matter of material resources? I want the best space in the office and I'm going to get it, by golly, that kind of thing. Okay. Two, timing. It's very, very important. You simply do not walk up to someone when they're super angry and not in a position to listen, or at 3:30 in the afternoon on a Friday when everybody's going to go out at the end of the day at 5 and initiate a conflict. You simply don't try to or initiate the resolution. You don't do that when you've just got through talking to your teenager. They're really uptight. They don't want to talk right now, and they're not ready to listen, and you're going to try to resolve the conflict. So timing is very, very important. And the best time is when you can actually pick out a time where it's kind of cool and a time where you can at least be in a neutral place. So cooling off. And whenever possible, a safe place or in a neutral place. One of the best ways to resolve conflict, believe it or not, is when you sit down and share food together. It really works. And you began to open up, and I don't mean just sitting there eating and looking at one another, I mean really sharing food. Another thing that I have done, and it works, is that if you're going to have a conflict, sometimes it may be better not to necessarily have a barrier between you. I have seen it work with couples where the two couples are really having a problem. If you can get them to sit facing one to one, facing one another, in a fairly close proximity, almost kneecap to kneecap, it is simply amazing how that works. If sister and brother are really having problems, sometimes, not always, but sometimes it really works to have them sit face to face and to hold one another's hand. It's kind of interesting. It really is interesting. And you'll see they want to pull away. I don't want to touch her. You know, I don't like her. She's looking at me, that kind of thing. But however you want to do that, but a safe place. You don't try to resolve a conflict when you're on somebody else's turf, especially in the commercial world. You don't try to resolve a conflict when there's something else of higher priority at this point in time. It's going to make the time taken to do this such a short frame thing that they feel pushed or the urgency to get out of there and to simply bypass all that's going on. Then three, then at that point in time, you must have the ability I want to stop there for a minute. There's one more, the use of problem-solving techniques. But really, these are negotiating skills. And I know we kind of move into some rather heavy-duty training business-type stuff, but it works, and it is essential. The ability to hear somebody else's point of view is very, very important, but sometimes it's very, very hard, especially if you already have made up in your mind, this is where you're coming from, and this is right. But let me walk through with you just a little bit on listening to another person's point of view. It really and truly helps. I did not think, to tell you the truth, that it would make any difference. If I took a position, I knew I was right, very firm in my belief, why should I listen to somebody else? Really, why should I listen? The answer to that question is that for some reason which research has not supplied us with, the fact that another human being experiences being understood by somebody else diffuses so much animosity. It may be that we really don't get along. We don't even like one another. We really don't. But, and my attitude towards you would be very, very hostile. But if I thought for 1 minute you would sit and just listen to me and not necessarily agree. Agreement, in this country especially, agreement is taken the wrong way. If I understand what you're saying, that is taken as tacit agreement. Because I understand you doesn't mean that I agree with you. But for you to experience understanding from me, or for me to experience your understanding of what I'm saying and the meaning of my words, that for some reason has a way of diffusing so much stuff. It simply melts away a lot of superficial barriers that get in our way. So this business of listening to another's point of view is extremely critical. That's the most critical thing that we could talk about today on this subject. Here's how it works. Number one, you enter into a conversation with someone or a dialogue with someone, and you simply suspend all judgment of what the person is saying. Hard to do, but you suspend all judgment of what the other person is saying. I have a client, I still have this client, who's really struggling with homosexuality. And it is an area that I have a very, very clear philosophical belief about. And yet I know that as a counselor, I cannot go in with my value structure, my ethical or religious belief or whatever that may be, and lay that on that person, because I might as well say, well, I don't want to talk to you, go find somebody else. Well, it's not that easy. When you're dealing with people who are in poverty, when you're dealing with people who have nowhere else to go, and you're supposed to be in some kind of ministry, you gotta listen. I'm sure that Jesus did not condone adultery, but he certainly did not kick the woman out or throw a stone at her. He listened. As a matter of fact, he just was there. He didn't even listen, he was present. So this person, I had to suspend all of my belief systems about that situation and really stay open to this person. But I discovered that the person, contrary to what I thought was going on, had the same type of problems that you and I have. You really have the same kind of problems. The person has the same type of fears. Person has the same type of hang-ups that I have. It's very interesting. And here's a person, myself, with all this training and education, and I had no idea how terribly prejudicial I felt against this man who is a homosexual. I mean, there's no excuse for that. Well, maybe not, and maybe so. But to suspend judgment and simply get into the other person's world of meaning, try to be as empathetic as you can. You can be empathetic with a murderer if he's sitting there in the chair and he's getting ready to get booked. You don't have to condone what he's done. You don't even have to like him. But you can certainly empathize with his fear, with his anger, with his upsetness for being caught, his terrible antisocial ways. You can see that if he's confined, this is how he's going to act. Empathy is not the same as sympathy, and understanding is not the same as agreement. It's important that we understand those things, and I think that is really the beginning of the exercise of a kind of Christian posture to take when dealing with things that are at odds with your own belief system. So, number one, suspend all judgment of what you are hearing and make an effort to be in the other person's world of meaning. Why? So that you can better understand what that person is, and secondly, when a person experiences you understanding what they're saying, you diffuse a whole group of kinds of resistance, and it is better, it makes a better situation for conversion or for listening out or maybe thinking in another position. So you're not doing it because you're being a milquetoast or you're trying to pull a trick on someone. You're using a very real, very human, a very, very practical way to open the door for communication. Question? Yes.
You know, I experienced that once with a student, and it turned out that just because I sat down with him, what he said to me later was, I appreciate the fact that you respected me enough to sit down, and what that did was make him listen to me even closer.
You're getting there. You're about step three down the line. That's right. I also want to say to you, do not take what I've said to you just now as something that's going to work. Remember, you're the one with the tools and the knowledge of conflict resolution. Chances are, most of the time, you're going to run into someone who doesn't know anything about what we're talking about here, and they're going to be resistant in spite of that. So don't look for the possibility of something just happening, but it is likely to happen. So that's number one, listen to the other's point of view, putting yourself in that person's world of meaning and suspending judgment. Another part of listening to the other's point of view is number two, if I can make a number two, move for clarity of what is being said. So often, people will say things, and what happens is we get into a kind of nonverbal communication game. One of the ways that you can tell that's going on is when a person says to you, you know what I mean? Right? So like, here's what happened, right? Well, I don't know what do you mean, right? Sometimes really challenge people by not jumping on them, but simply getting them to make clear in their speech what they're trying to say to you. A typical example is, so okay, I was talking to this guy, right? Well, I guess so. Were you talking to him or weren't you? But haven't you heard that before? And they'll say, she goes, well, what do you mean she goes? We have picked up so many little idioms and so many little colloquial expressions, and it's creeped into the language that people assume you are on their wavelength. That is not necessarily true. And what happens is, darn it if not, we play their game and say, yeah, okay. And we don't really know what they mean, but we say, yeah, okay. So be very, very strict about that. Really move for clarity of what is being said. If you know anything about paraphrasing, great. If you don't know what that means, simply repeat back to them what you think they said. Now, just a minute, hold it now. Tell me if I'm right. You're saying that you really and truly don't want to be involved in this program. Is that what you're saying? Right, and then they may want to go on again. Oh, no, that's okay, I understand. Okay, I see what you're saying now. You're saying that you don't want to be involved in this. Oh, okay, I understand that. Now, when you do that, you must be careful because it's working the other way. You say, oh, yeah, okay, I understand that. What that person may be hearing is, oh, yeah, I agree with you. So if you understand what the person is saying, you move for clarity of what the person is saying, and you acknowledge the understanding, you must also, if you don't agree with them, you must immediately come back with, you know, I understand what you're saying now. I don't agree with you, but I really do understand what your conflict is. So acknowledge understanding, and if you do not understand, then immediately add to that your disagreement. And you can say it in a way that is not hostile. And I guarantee you, the person's not going to jump off. Just simply say, oh, okay, so in other words, this is what the situation is for you. And you read back to the person exactly how they feel. It is simply amazing. I can't tell you why that happens. There's nothing in the literature that I've looked at in the last year that explains the studies or the statistics why people are that way. But you yourself know that if you're understood, whether the person agrees with you or not, it's a good feeling. If the person can really get in your head and say, oh, that's what you're saying. So that's important. The next step then is to get permission. Very important. Get permission to tell your side or give your point of view. What do you mean get permission? This kid's he's a 10th grader, he doesn't know anything, and he's arrogant, and I can't stand him, and besides, I don't like him anyway. And I'm in charge here. I'm the teacher. Well, I'm the parent. I don't need permission from my kid to tell this kid what he has to do. Well, there's a strategy there. What you do is you model politeness and respect. And secondly, once you get permission from the person to hear your point of view, then you can hold them to it. You know, I sat and I really made an effort to understand what you're saying. I only ask that you do the same for me. That's all. If the person doesn't want to do that, then at that point in time, break it off. There's no sense in doing anything else, because if you do anything else, you end up in an argument. The resolution will become less and less likely, and the conflict will become really, really stuck. And the person, then what happens is you've destroyed all that you've done, and the person becomes very recalcitrant in their view. So if the person says, no, I don't want to hear what you have to say, I'm sick of it, that's it, you say, fine, then we're done talking. I guess that's it. If you're talking to a superior, is there anything else you have before I leave, or is there anything else you want to say? Fine, well then I'm going back to my work, or I'm moving on. If it's a subordinate, well, if that's the case, I guess we might as well go on with the rules. This is what I want you to do, and you'll have to do it. It's unfortunate that we can't continue the talk, but that's it, this is what you must do. If it's a peer, or somebody you're dealing with who's on the same level with you, you simply say, I really feel bad that I couldn't give my point of view, but if that's how you feel, that's fine. And then, believe me, break it off. Don't try to resolve anything beyond that point. You cannot get the other person to sit still and hear what you have to say. You can talk to your turn blue in the face. Won't do any good. So the secret to resolution is to keep the door open and move for the collective use of strength and force to resolve something for the common good. If they don't want to play, take your marbles and go home.
You know, that's the point of view. Here again, you have a good
student. In working with in a early child setting, I don't do that type of service anymore, but I still do in service for teachers and for daycare center providers. And one of the things we try to teach them is lay the ground rules ahead of time, children, and they understand symbols. When there's an argument or a conflict with young people, you give the symbol timeout. You have a timeout. And then you have a place where you go, and it's called the peace place. You know, if you're dealing with early child, you've got sit upons, and there's the story corner, there's the activity corner, there's the bathroom, there's a nap place over here. There's a peace corner here. And it doesn't make any difference what denomination they're in, or whether or not they're hardcore fundamentalists, or mainstream, organized and fairly open Lutheran, Catholic, Episcopal Methodist. It makes no difference, really. But there's a peace corner. And in there, and what I've
told people to do. That Peace Corner is a special place. First of all, you go there whenever there's a problem and you want to solve your problem. And a universal, a dove, maybe a candle, and maybe the Bible or something. It doesn't have to be a religious program. It may be very, very non-sectarian, and in some cases you've got to be careful because you don't get the federal funding if you stick a Bible up there. But it's a Peace Corner. It's a place where you go, and they understand when it's time out, they have to go to the Peace Corner and work it out. Sometimes that means doing nothing but just sitting still and being quiet. Other times, indeed, it's a time for them to resolve any doubt. And in that case, there are times when they allow the children to go in and do it on their own. Somebody's there monitoring, but you're not allowed to fight in the Peace Corner. You cannot act out in the Peace Corner, and you're not allowed to yell in the Peace Corner. It's amazing what happens when you get people, children and grown-ups, if we can resolve our conflict, but we agree not to holler at one another. It's amazing. Because hollering simply raises the level of resistance. Because if I can yell louder than you, then that's the way I can vent my anger at you. If we're not allowed to holler or yell, it's amazing what happens. Another point about the Peace Corner is something that adults don't really do all the time, seldom do, is that everybody must be polite to the next person. And you can even make those kind of rules with grown-ups in the workplace. That no matter whatever you say, or no matter how right or wrong you may think you are, no matter how right or wrong I think I may be, when we have a place where we work these things out, I make an agreement. Look, we really have this problem. I need your help in helping me understand where you are. And I want to do it with dignity and with respect for you. So I'm not going to raise my voice and scream at you. If we can't meet agreement, then let's break off. But I would like very much to understand. And I'm willing to listen to you first. If you could tell me what you think is happening. And this business of the ability to hear the other's point of view is important, because sometimes when you listen to their point of view, you may hear a lot of accusatory language aimed at you. Do not defend yourself. Do not accept it. But don't say, yeah, you're right, I did that, I'm sorry. Just listen. And then your response is, now let me see if I've got this right. I really need to understand this. You think that I'm very, very pushy and that I really don't care about how you feel. Also, you think that I'm the one that had you transferred out of the other department. And that I'm really kind of, chauvinist, that I don't care about you, and I don't think that because you're a woman you can do that. That's what you think, right? I mean, that's what you're saying. It's amazing when a person hears their thoughts come back to them in a non-violent, non-aggressive way. You got to get, they got to think, well, yeah, because, okay, so that's what's really causing you to have difficulty with me right now. Okay, I understand that. I don't agree with everything you're saying, but I really do understand why you're saying that, because that's how you feel, right? I mean, am I correct on that? It's amazing. Repeating myself, but that's extremely important. The last point out of point hearing the other's point of view is, once again, get permission to give yours. If people don't want to do that, break it off and try another time. Then, of course, the other piece to that is, once you've been able to identify the problem in the conflict, you go through simply the simplest problem-solving procedure that you can. You work together on solutions. At this point in time, you move from the I and the you to the we. What do you think we can do to solve this problem? And you come up with some ideas. First of all, what do you want? What do you really want out of this? And you got to get the person to start saying what they want. And, well, let me tell you what I want out of this. And how can we achieve these things together? It's simply amazing. I remember one conflict resolution situation where I was the one in conflict, and I hated this person. I hate to say that to you, but I couldn't stand this person. When it was all over with, this person became a very, very dear, close friend of mine. They shipped out since then, they've gone somewhere else, have gone back east. But this person I became the best of friends, simply because we start working together towards a common goal. Okay. So
after you do that and you've got the goals, then the next thing you do is that you figure out when, you come up with a plan to do it. Okay, so from now on, when I come in, I will not walk across your path, or I will not turn the light on at this time, or I will indeed run this paper by your desk before I send it upstairs to the higher level. I will stop using these kind of jokes in the break room. I will make an effort that you must, and I want you to help me to use more inclusive language when I talk about my staff. And if I'm giving an illustration, I will use inclusive language, or at least sometimes give example with women. I won't tell any more good old boy jokes, since you think and you feel that that's a racial slur, I won't do that anymore, because that's not my intention to hurt your feelings. I just thought it was a funny joke. I mean, you got to admit it was funny. Yep, okay. But I won't use that anymore, okay? That kind of thing. And it's that kind of give and take, almost a release of the pressure that brings that thing out. And then after you've decided how you're going to do that, then you come up with a time you're going to do it. You actually come up, now starting tomorrow, or shall we start this afternoon? I know this sounds kind of funny, but you really have to nail it down. And then finally, the most important thing, that you don't find in other problem-solving schemes, is you agree to come back 30, 60, 14 days later to see how we doing, how is it working for us? Is there something that I need to do better? Have I been doing okay? I need some feedback from you. That kind of thing is most important. So that, I guess that's the whole crux of it. Interpersonal peacemaking, intergroup peacemaking, people of different groups and backgrounds peacemaking. And sometimes you don't always make successful inroads using this thing I've shared with you. But I'd like to say that there are more times that you will than there are times that you won't.